They're all hanging over me. I've got the whole studio full of people here. Okay, because that officially started until right about now.
See you
guys. Okay, here we are, Evening Under Lamplight. We've got one lamplight on in the studio. The other one, well, I haven't got to it. It's over there. It makes no difference anyway because I have to put the overhead light on. Wait, I've got a guest in the studio, Andrew Abey from Liverpool, who has just turned on the lamplight. So now we're double lamplight, bringing to you Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and as I've said, our guest, Andrew Abey from Liverpool. This, of course, is the show that invites you to attend, and I'm not reading from a script tonight. I'm just ad-libbing it from a few notes. So this will be, we hope, a little bit lighter. Maybe it'll be heavier. Who knows? It all depends. Maybe it'll be completely lost. Here's what we're doing tonight. First, I'm going to read this week's passage from Walt Whitman. We'll just read it. But then we'll talk about some other things, and then at the end, we'll return to Whitman. So we're reading Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, and we enter into the next part of the long poem, which is really much more about Whitman himself, or the poet himself. And here, I really enjoyed reading this section, and so let's get ready. Who goes there, hankering, gross, mystical, nude? How is it I extract strength from the beef I eat? What is a man, anyhow? What am I? And what are you? All I mark as my own, you shall offset it with your own, else it were time lost listening to me. I do not snivel that snivel the world over, that months are vacuums and the ground but wallow and filth, that life is a suck and a sell, and nothing remains at the end but threadbare crepe and tears. Whimpering and truckling fold with powders for invalids. Conformity goes to the fourth remove. I cock my hat as I please, indoors or out. Shall I pray? Shall I venerate and be ceremonious? I have pried through the strata and analyzed to a hair and counseled with doctors and calculated close and found no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones. In all people I see myself, none more and not one a barleycorn less, and the good or bad I say of myself, I say of them. And I know I am solid and sound. To me the converging objects of the universe perpetually flow. All are written to me, and I must get what the writing means. And I know I am deathless. I know this orbit of mine cannot be swept by a carpenter's compass. I know I shall not pass like a child's carlicue cut with a burnt stick at night. I know I am august. I do not trouble my spirit to vindicate itself or be understood. I see that the elementary laws never apologize. I reckon I behave no prouder than the level I plant my house by, after all. I exist as I am. That is enough. If no other in the world be aware, I sit content. And if each and all be aware, I sit content. One world is aware, and by far the largest to me, and that is myself. And whether I come to my own today, or in 10,000 or 10 million years, I can cheerfully take it now, or with equal cheerfulness I can wait. My foothold is tenoned and mortised in granite. I laugh at what you call dissolution, and I know the amplitude of time.
I won't take all that they hand me down. They kind of smile, though I wear a frown. And I'm not gonna take it all lying down. 'Cause once I get started, I go to town. Confess all my sins like you want me to. There's one thing that I will say to you. I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. Like you want me to. There's one thing that I will say to you. I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else.
Well, Walt Whitman was so proud of being his own unique self that I thought we should follow with the Kinks' I'm Not Like Everybody Else. But of course, Walt Whitman says he is like everybody else. He's exactly like everybody else. Let's see, the good and bad I say of myself, I say of them, of everybody else. So Whitman is both uniquely himself and everybody else. And you know what? So are you, and so are you. Andrew said, I have no idea what that's all about. You can put the mic up if you want, Andrew.
All I will do is confess my ignorance. I had no idea what was happening in that poem, apart from little snatches. I'm just very glad that you'll be explaining it later on.
Well, I hope I will. And and because you're here, you can tell me if I don't do a good enough job. We could have people calling in and saying, hello, look, that fourth line, that third word, what exactly did you mean? But that's calling my bluff, and we won't have that, I don't think. Right. No, we want to move on to something else. Now, this is, I was talking to Andrew about this the other day. This is just one sentence or part of a sentence that will take us, I hope, a long way. This is what you do if you learn how to be attentive and attend to literature. You can just have great fun. And it's a sentence from my man, Robert Louis Stevenson. Now, my co-editor, Richard Jury, was working on well, to call this an obscure essay is sort of overstating it or understating it. I mean, I don't know who has read this essay besides Richard and me over the past 1877 till today, whatever that is, how many years. And even in 1877, the magazine this came out in had such a poor circulation that very few people read it. So we're all sort of looking in on something that's not very well known. But it's an essay called In the Latin Quarter, A Studio of Ladies. Robert Louis Stevenson was living in Paris with his lover. She was taking art lessons from Carolus Duran, who was a reasonably famous painter at the time. She came all the way from California, Fanny Stevenson, Fanny Osborne did, to study art in Paris. And she arrived and she discovered that although the men could take lessons from the great masters and then pay for their lessons by filling in bits of the larger paintings the painter did, the women just had to pay money for tuition. She didn't have too much money, but she paid for tuition for herself and for her daughter. Now, Stevenson's very much aware of the inequality of the sexes in his time and was rather indignant about it. And he says that men control, he says, he knows, and we know this too, men control society because they're the ones with the money. In the old days, it was the powerful, strong, good-looking men who had the power, but now it's just rich men. Even if they're ugly and infirm, they can control whatever they want. And they exert their control by withholding or giving money. Or rather, how we exert control, because Stevenson has to. He identifies himself with the men, even though he's exposing and satirizing them. Okay, now here's the sentence I want us to look at. We still have the pull, we men, he says, because we carry the purse. The ball is still at our feet. But we are aware of our peril. We know we must keep the money greedily to ourselves, for we are fonder of women than they are of us. We must bribe them to come to us as we bribe a child with a sugar almond for a kiss. And if once they have all our sugar almonds, they will leave us like a pack of satyrs sitting in dim oak coverts and hearing only afar off the voices and swift feet of Artemis's maidens. The main part of the sentence I want to go over once more. You probably got as little out of it from that reading as you got from the Whitman going through it first time. But that's why we read these things many times over. It's not like an academic classroom where they say, read this text for Wednesday. You rush your way through it, skipping pages, hurriedly trying to say you've got it done in time for class, or not getting it done, and then having a lecture on it, writing an essay on it, and never catching what the passage is all about. That's why I say we must go over it several times. This part of the sentence has five clauses separated by semicolons, which is one of Stevenson's stylistic quirks. Here it goes. But we men are aware of peril. We know we must keep the money greedily to ourselves. For we are fonder of women than they are of us. We must bribe them to come to us as we bribe a child with a sugar almond for a kiss. And if once they have all our sugar almonds, they will leave us. They will leave us like a pack of satyrs sitting in the dim oak coverts and hearing only afar off the voices and swift feet of Artemis's maidens. Right, now you've got it. Here's the exam question. No exams for this. Mm. What is he saying? Women want to be independent of men, but the men have the money, so they bribe the women into compliance by offering them the money the women need. But once men have no money, the women will not be compliant. They will leave the men and go off to do what they want. Okay? I've just paraphrased the sentence. There are two analogies, two comparisons. First of all, we bribe women as we bribe a child with sugar almond for a kiss. So get a sense of that picture. Auntie Jane has come for a visit. The kid's playing with his toys. Here's a sweetie for you if you come here and give your Auntie Jane a kiss. So the kid leaves his toys. He goes over. He gives her the kiss. He takes a sugar almond and runs back to his games. That's one image. Then there is that the women leave the men like a pack of satyrs. That's S-A-T-Y-R. I'll explain that in a minute. Like a pack of satyrs sitting in dim oak coverts. That's little shady parts of the woods with oak trees. Sitting in dim oak coverts and hearing only afar off the voices and swift feet of Artemis's maidens. Okay, so we have two different woodland creatures here. They're the satyrs, shaggy, goat-footed, sunshiny, lewd, and cruel, as Stevenson said of the great god Pan. They hang around the woods, and they're horny. In fact, that's where we get the word horny, because these satyrs have goat feet and horns on top of their heads, like goats. Goats were known for being ruttish. The satyrs hang around. They just drink. I don't know what they drink. Wine, probably, in big casks. And they're looking for sex. That's the one kind of woodland creature we have here. The other one are Artemis's maidens. Now, Artemis, as you, of course, all recall, was also known as Diana by the Romans. She was the goddess of the hunt, goddess of the moon. She was a virgin goddess. She was also, for some odd reason, the goddess of childbirth, and also had associations with the underworld. But we won't go into that. As a virgin goddess, she shunned men. She would have nothing to do with men or sex. She ran around accompanied by her maidens. She was almost never depicted alone, I think, almost always with her girls all around her. A sisterhood, you see, and I think she's in that sense the goddess of sisterhood. And the women hanging around her, her maidens, are all enjoying sports and hunting and the game, and they play around, or when they get too hot, they go to a pool of water and they splash around, they have good fun together. But there's no sex about it. Some people try to talk about that as sort of a lesbian gang. There's no sex about it. That's the whole point. It's time now to stop for a song. And I want to play, what kind of song can we present that is sort of associated with Artemis's maidens, perhaps even with satyrs? I can't remember what made me think of this song, but it's a great song. It's the Marvelettes song, The Hunter Gets Captured by the Game. She lays a trap for him, she stalks him, but certain things rearrange. And as soon as he puts his arms around her, she's captured. There's a combination of the satyrs and Artemis's maidens. This version I'm playing for you has the extra middle verse, which I'm sure you'll be very excited to hear, because, of course, you all know the song so well. It's 1966, did I say that? And it is the Marvelettes, who have this wonderful voice, a wonderful sound. They were overshadowed by the Supremes, which I always lamented. I was sort of a Marvelettes guy. The Miracles and the Marvelettes were the two first big hits in Motown. Now, this song is written by Smokey Robinson from The Miracles. Of course it is. Smokey's trademark is to take a cliché and build it up into a song. And the cliché is the hunter, gets captured by the game. So how are we going to build up a song with that? Well, you wait and see. The main singer is Wanda Young Rogers, and the background is played by the Funk Brothers, who are just marvelous in themselves. Let's see what we can find here. there were the Marvelettes. Actually, they're known for us in Philadelphia as the Marvelous Marvelettes. The hunter gets captured by the game, and that's the way radio ought to sound. And, of course, a Smokey Robinson song is also very sparkly for the rhymes. She laid a tender trap, hoping he might fall into it. And then it happened with a sudden snap. One kiss, and then I knew it. Fall into it, then I knew it. Only Smokey would do that. And I think that's why Bob Dylan once called him the greatest poet of our time. Right. Well, you remember, we're talking about Satyrs and Artemis's maidens. Now, we've sort of typecast them. The Satyrs are like the horny guys sitting around drinking beer, watching the football on a Saturday afternoon. No girls allowed. And the Artemis's maidens are, you know, what are they doing? Upstairs, they're talking about whatever they want to talk about or playing games together. But they're not just typecasting. All these myths refer to larger elements in our lives. The Satyrs are not just sort of sexy predators, but they lurking in the woods, you see, springing out on any maiden who comes past here. But they also represent those moments in life when life surprises us with sudden things. We're walking through a wood and we're attacked by wild desires that we never expected. The other day I was walking down Euston Road and it was dusk, the rush hour. I was walking away from King's Cross, and so you can imagine all these people are running and walking fast towards King's Cross. And I was actually smiling because it was funny to watch this. But suddenly the sunlight hit the roof of a building and, wow, I was assaulted by this great desire for that beauty. That was a Satyr moment. Or maybe you're reading a book. You're lost in the woods of the plot or something. And a detail springs out and it catches you. That's a Satyr moment. Artemis's maidens. The love of a sport, a game, a craft, or any occupation, you can become Artemis's maiden. It's to the exclusion of thinking about being attractive. You know, you're putting on the kind of clothes that suit the occupation, not this kind of clothes that are going to make you attractive to other people. Often the devotee engages in self-denial. That's called asceticism. There's an awful, all the Greek tragedies are awful, but there's one by Euripides called Hippolytus, about Hippolytus, who was a devotee of Artemis, the goddess we're talking about. He scorned Aphrodite, the goddess of love. And in revenge, because all these Greek stories are about the pain of life, don't look for happy endings. You get them very seldom. In revenge, Aphrodite got Phaedra, who was Hippolytus' stepmother. You with me? She got Phaedra to fall in love with Hippolytus. She kept the love a secret, but Hippolytus found out, and it's just appalled. I don't want these women loving me. What's going on here? And there's this famous speech he gives, praying to Zeus, the king of the gods. He says, "Oh, Zeus, why did you create and put on earth with men's..." Do that again. "Oh, Zeus, why did you create and put on earth with men so vile and worthless a thing as woman? If you wanted to propagate the human race, you didn't have to do it through women." He says, "Better that men should buy children from you, paying at your temples in gold or iron or bronze, each man what he could afford. Then they could live in freedom in their own homes without women. Women are a great curse to men." Now, that's a great idea. But, of course, then the rich people would get all the best children. Whoops, time for a little song.
Rachel, what a strange world this would be if the men were all transported far beyond the northern sea.
Reuben, Reuben, I've been thinking what a great life girls would lead if they had no man about them, none to tease them, none to heed.
Rachel, Rachel, I've been thinking men would have a merry time if at once they were transported far beyond the salty brine.
me, I will take you for my wife, and I'll split with you my money. Every payday of my life.
Okay, that was called either Reuben, or sometimes it's called Reuben and Rachel. I'm sorry, I really think that's terrible. It's not just a terrible song, but it's a terrible version of it. And, somehow it came to my mind, and it comes from, and it's been in my mind for off and on. It comes every now and again, and thanks to YouTube, you can hear anything you ever want. But it's from long, long ago, and I have this memory. I have this awful memory that my father taught it to me. Maybe my grandfather as this kind of, hey, it's a boy's song, you know, and we like, and I thought it was so grown. I don't think it was a children's song. I thought it was like what grown-ups say, but I didn't remember the ending where they decide, they're only teasing, and I don't know if you caught that. They say, well, I was only teasing, and hey, let's get married after all. And so you know, that makes me want to throw up. That's really a terrible song. But there we go. You know, sometimes when I do the show and I listen to the music before I do the show and then I listen to it afterwards, for 3-4 days afterwards, I've got the music from the show playing in my head over and over, and I'm just hoping that this is not the one that goes over and over my mind. I think it backs out of the difficult Artemis chastity by admitting the misogyny and misanthropy was just teasing. We really do like the girls. We do like the boys. And they'll get married. Now, Andrew was saying, was I implying that Hippolytus then becomes Artemis's maiden? And I was. And that's the point about the myths, that gender doesn't mean anything. You can be Artemis's maiden if you are a man or a woman, if you're married or not. That doesn't matter, because these are just representations of powers and forces and spirits that move in and out of our lives at all times. Another kind of Artemis maiden is the nerd. I think I can work this out. All obsessive people belong to Artemis. You know, the stereotype nerd who forgets about taking showers or nail clipping or laundry. And then it strikes me that another example is the absent-minded professor. And I guess that's where I come into the game, because what was I talking about? Oh, yes. I'm an absent-minded professor, too. Well, listen, back to the sentence, because that's what we were started with. And this is how we play with literature. We go round and round and come back all the time to the sentence. It will mean a lot more to you, I think, this time. We are fonder of women than they are of us. We must bribe them to come to us as we bribe a child with a sugar almond for a kiss. And if once they have all our sugar almonds, they will leave us like a pack of satyrs sitting in dim oak coverts and hearing only afar off the voices and swift feet of Artemis's maidens. So we get three pictures. One, men getting women to do what they want them to do by providing them with money, and then the women leaving the men once they get enough for their needs. Two, adults bribing children with sweets to come and reluctantly give them a kiss. Maybe it's even pederasts, but I'm sure he hasn't got this in mind. That there's no point bringing that sort of thing in here. One day, my son Neil came home from school about 5 years old. This is a great story. I may have told this. I don't know. He came home from school. Dad, look what we did. Look, we learned all about strangers today. And look, see this picture. Never take sweets from a stranger, Dad. I said, okay. And he shows me the picture and he says, Dad, you must never accept a ride from a stranger, okay? You must never accept a ride from a stranger. I said, good. He says, and Dad, I said, yeah, Dad, what's a stranger? You know that story.
I do.
What's a stranger?
He was 26 at the time, wasn't he?
I think that's right. Because, yes. You know, I taught you to grow up with nobody being strangers. We're Walt Whitman, right? Everybody is me and I'm everybody. Mm-hmm. All right. And then, of course, the third part is the satyrs sitting alone in the woods, desiring the maidens they can hear running and shouting in the distant part of the woods as they enjoy themselves without men while hunting and racing around. See, then suddenly the local event of women paying for art lessons at the studio of Carolus Duran in Paris in 1877, which is where we started, becomes enlarged onto a mythic canvas. It's partly in play, partly to make a general point about men's relationship with women. Stevenson's not going to sour the essay by hammering this home. But with the one passing mythic allusion, he touches upon the great human sorrow of thwarted longing and mistreatment and misunderstanding. But if you don't get the Greek references, you know, you miss this whole thing. And most people, I'm afraid today, will miss it. But that's why we've got me here to help you catch and attend to all these things. Here on, here's a station identification, here on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. This is Evening Under Lamplight with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Now, what sort of song could we follow this by to represent the men's desire, the satyr's desire to have sex with women, and then the Artemis's maiden's desire to stay away from men? For the first part, I thought about... do you know this song by Dr. Hook called "Looking for Pussy"? It sort of appears as the final track on one of their obscure CDs. Like, they wouldn't put it on the label because they won't tell us. It is far too crass. It is really crass. I was going to pretend like it's looking for a lost pet, but we know it's not. So we're not going to hear "Looking for Pussy." Though that would describe the satyr's spirit of things. Instead, we'll have the Rolling Stones, let's Spend the Night Together, which has that kind of driving energy that I think represents the spirit of the satyrs.
Bye.
Well, there's the Rolling Stones, the Satyrs of popular music there. It's the energy more than the words that impresses me here, and that's the spirit of a satyr. You can't resist the energy of this song, even if you want to resist his approaches. At least he says he will satisfy her, so he's not entirely selfish, and I don't think satyrs are entirely selfish. They just want to have a good time. The next song is from the woman's point of view, and it's—I don't know if you know this song. It was a sort of a hit for Motown. We're back to Motown. it's a group called the Velvelettes. Now, I had a very dear friend, Chip Tucker, in college, who wrote an essay in the history of English language class. He wrote an essay about the Motown use of Latinate names for the singers. So you've got Supremes, Temptations, Marvelettes. The only one that is not is Four Tops. Those are good Anglo-Saxon words. Everybody else has got these Velvelettes. needle in a haystack. Let's go. Velvelettes, needle in a haystack. And even though it is made up almost entirely of, that's Andrew's water bottle making that clicking noise.
Sorry.
Even though it's made up almost entirely of cliches, you better look before you leap. Still waters can run very deep. It wasn't written by Smokey Robinson, but Winfield, I think, wrote it. And he obviously learned his lesson from the master. Now, it's time to go back to Walt Whitman. Remember Walt Whitman, or as we say in Philadelphia, Walt Whitman. We have the Walt Whitman Bridge, and I won't even go into the reasons and the controversy about that Walt Whitman Bridge. Someday I'll tell you the scandal about the bridge. Who goes there, hankering, gross, mystical, nude? That's what I'm calling this episode, by the way. Hankering, gross, mystical, nude. Four words, hankering, hanging about, as well as craving, like the satyrs, sitting in dim oak cupboards. He's not drooling, he's not hanging around in idleness, but waiting on some desire, hankering, and gross. That can, there's lots of different meanings for gross. Big-bodied, unwholesomely fat. Ew, what a gross person. But also, and I think this is the main symbol here, Whitman often uses obsolete meanings of words. And this is an obsolete sense of gross, meaning plain or evident, easy to apprehend. You can't miss me, he's saying to us. My message is pushed right up in front of you. Gross can also mean stupid or dull, but that doesn't apply here at all, I think. The third word is mystical, in touch with the higher things, not just out for material advantage, in touch with the great unity. And, of course, we've been seeing that all along in this poem. The only way Whitman can say that all things come towards me, and they also all come towards you too, is because he sees that we are all united in the mystical unity. And nude. You can't say nude. Nude. Now, obsolete meaning of nude is open or explicit. It also, of course, means undressed, but not in the neutral sense. It means it's got a sort of suggestive or gratuitous display. We could read Robert Graves' Naked and the Nude, but I've not got that here with me. There's also the sense of a nude, which is a picture of an undressed person, a picture on display for us to look at and admire. And in a sense, that's what Whitman is doing. He's painting a picture of himself for us to look at, and then actually, like a mirror, we look at Whitman and we are learning something about ourselves. And this can be frightening. Anybody who's so open like Whitman can frighten us and raise all our fears. We feel very vulnerable. He looks very threatening. And I think I'm going to play you this song, which is a nasty song, like almost all of Randy Newman's songs. It's called Naked Man. Listen to it, and I'll have a few words to say about it afterwards. Randy Newman, Naked Man. We also want to send out a little hello to Sonia in Liverpool, listening in live on stream, or streamed on live. Naked Man, Randy Newman's Naked Man. He's an obvious threat, but he comes out of nowhere through the snow and sleet on the coldest night of the year. I suppose like a satyr. And he startles her. Beware of the Naked Man. What's he robbing her of? And in the end, she said, I think it's she who's saying, won't nobody help the Naked Man? Has he awoken her compassion? Is he robbed her of her purse but opened up her heart? That's what I suppose naked men do. Hankering, gross, mystical, nude. Now there's more questions. What is a man anyway? What am I? And, what are you? Then he's going to tell us. The answer will come by offsetting what Whitman says about himself, the man with insight, against ourselves. All I mark as my own, you shall offset it with your own, else it were time lost listening to me. Why read anything if you can't then take it in to yourself? Okay, one of the lessons he offers us is to caution against despair. Okay, life is good. That's his great affirmation. And this world is not the only world. I do not snivel the world over, that months are vacuums, that is to say, nothing ever happens. The ground but wallow and filth, it's all ugly. That life is a suck and a sell, those must be slang words from 1850 New York. Hey, it's just suck, man, and it's a sell. And nothing remains at the end but threadbare crepe and tears. That is, this threadbare crepe is the black mourning cloth that you had to wear when somebody in your family died. It's grown threadbare because you've been wearing it for a whole year of mourning, which is a very 19th century thing to do. And you've got all these tears. It's not true that nothing remains at the end but these things. There's more to life than that. And there's no conformity either. I cock my hat as I please, indoors or out. I wear what I want and how I want to, despite the rules of fashion. Of course he's his own person. He's in touch with the deeper self below the surface that fashions and obedience operate on. Then he asks, shall I pray? The answer is, to whom? If we're all one, then I can just reverence myself, and I'm reverencing everything that's sacred. Here's a little story about Nasruddin, the Sufi wise man fool. The priests walk into the temple, and they see Nasruddin sitting there with his feet up on the altar. And they say, get your feet off the altar, that's sacred space. And Nasruddin says, well, where else shall I put them then? It's all sacred space. Okay. Then comes a catalogue of I know statements. He knows the stuff intuitively, not rationally, so you can't explain these things, you just assert them. And I know that I am solid and sound. To me, the converging objects of the universe perpetually flow. And I know I am deathless. I know this orbit of mine cannot be swept by a carpenter's compass. It's bigger than any kind of circle you can make. I know I shall not pass like a child's carlicue cut with a burnt stick at night. That's a great image. The child's game, you take a glowing stick, you put it in the fire, you bring it out, and it's got a little glowing bit at the tip. At night, you make all sorts of circles and curlicues with it, and it seems to make a pattern in the air, but of course the pattern disappears. It doesn't last in the sky. And Whitman says, I shall not pass like a child's carlicue cut with a burnt stick at night. I'll do more than that. I last. That curlicue does not last. Is this egotistical? But he says, you're infinitely large too. So join me in my egotism. Okay. Else it were time lost. His certainty is so strong that he can stand firm even when no one else pays attention to him. I can cheerfully take it now, or with equal cheerfulness, I can wait. My foothold is tenoned and mortised in granite. I laugh at what you call dissolution, and I know the amplitude of time. And that's where we're going to end. this evening under lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, with my guest here, Andrew A.B. from Liverpool. We go out with the guy who's hankering gross, mystical and nude from his Live in London 2009 album, a song you all know. We need to hear it again. The song's name is Hallelujah, and the guy, of course, is Leonard Cohen.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you?
By the way, Andrew says he now understands the poems, so I hope you do too. Bye-bye.
I kind of understand the poem.
Okay, kind of understands it. That's right, that's all we can do. Let's go back to Leonard. Understand him if you dare.
Posing hallelujah. Hallelujah. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. 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 God above, as for me, all I ever learned from love is how to shoot at someone who outdrew you. But it's not a cry that you hear tonight. It's not some pilgrim who claims to have seen the light. No, it's a cold and it's a very